this afternoon with you about rhythms. And I'm not going to read to you this afternoon. I'm going to share a few thoughts, and then I'd like us to have a conversation. I said this morning that it's become more and more important to me to realize how placelessness shapes us, and intimately connected to that is, and a number of people have mentioned this, is the speed at which we're invited to live in our culture. Of course, placelessness is tied to mobility, and mobility means that you have to be moving, often pretty fast, and it's not just fast food. You know, what the automobile created in America was the idea that that we could be in places that we hadn't thought we could be before, and this is a huge transition. And of course, McDonald's jumped on the fact that if you could get food that was easy to eat in your car on the go, you know, in Southern California, then it would make it easier to keep going to have this speed. So you know, we have some people who there was this great documentary on the Fast Food Nation and that book that now what was the documentary called? It was Supersize Me. But the fast food, you know, there have been people who've been kind of trying to point up how the fast food and fast living is bad for our bodies, but it's so pervasive. It's much more than just fast food. I was thinking about when I did this book on stability, I did some research on this emerging field of attention science. Have y'all ever done any reading on attention science? I would recommend to you a popularization of some of this stuff by a woman named Maggie Jackson. Her book is called Distracted, and she's a journalist from the Boston Globe. But she pointed me to a lot of these people who've been doing research, and the corporate firms are paying a lot of money for this research because like I was saying, the speed of our society isn't just when we're in our cars and stopping by Burger King, but it has a lot to do with how we work in our workplaces now, and the speed at which we move, these attention scientists are finding, is actually decreasing our ability to pay attention to anything. So that this is one of the most shocking figures I came across. The average knowledge worker, and I think as ministers, y'all would be included in this. This is what most people who don't work with their hands every day. This would include all of those people. So people who work in offices, people who work in schools. People who work in churches, the average knowledge worker, they found changes tasks every 8 minutes. Every 8 minutes. And once you change tasks, they found that on average it takes 3 times that long to get back to what you were doing. so that you may have noticed this in your own life, that when things get hectic, And you're busy, and the phone's ringing, and the text messages are coming in, and the email is happening, and whatever other ways people have of getting in touch with you, you feel like you get into this constant loop of activity that never ends. So that the 40-hour work week, or 45 or 50-hour work week, has just sort of stretched into a never-ending work time. In which we're constantly being interrupted by all kinds of different things. Here's an extreme case of this. I have a friend who's a psychologist, and he tells me that people are coming in for therapy about this more and more because they find their lives unmanageable. It is a sort of addiction, he says, and he's been trying to work with people on it. But he actually told me a story. Of course, he didn't tell me his name, but he told me a story about a person who came in saying that they had a problem with distraction, that they couldn't rest. They had so many sort of ways of people getting in touch with them, and then getting in touch with other people. They couldn't ever rest. And he said that they were sitting in a session, and this person had their hand in their pocket, and their hand was moving around. And he said, "What are you doing?" And the person said, "Oh, I'm sorry. I was just sending a quick text message in the midst of the therapy session on trying to make sense of this problem. All this to say, I think speed affects us on all sorts of levels. It's not just our bodies moving, but I think it's deeply affected our neural pathways. Our minds are always moving in this hypermobile culture, and it's led me to spend some time with this thing that the monastic tradition names. It's a spiritual malady that the monastic tradition names, and it's called acedia. Have y'all ever come across this notion of acedia? Acedia. Acedia. It literally means a lack of care. A lack of care. But it comes out of the desert tradition. Saint Anthony of the desert. We know about the desert from the sayings. These folks didn't write anything. Athanasius wrote a Life of Anthony, and then we have collections of sayings. And then we have reports of tourists who went, some of them quite theologically educated tourists, but they went and listened to the mothers and fathers and then wrote about them. But in the collection of sayings that was gathered over years and years and that we have in a couple different forms, there's an alphabetical form, and Anthony's right there at the beginning. And the sayings that are attributed to Anthony begin with a saying about what happened to Anthony when he was facing this acedia. It says that he was out in his cell. He was praying, and he was struggling. He was struggling with how to pray continually. Of course, prayer was his work, right? And how could he sit and pray all the time? Because after all, Paul had said, pray without ceasing. And he wanted to embody that, to live that out as a vocation of someone who had been called to pray for the sake of the world. So it was a serious commitment for him, but he was struggling with all the distractions that happen when you try to sit and pray all the time. You might have had this experience yourself. He and others in the tradition of hermits and desert monasticism have testified to the evil thoughts that come, or the bad thoughts. There's a whole tradition of bad thoughts that come out of desert monasticism. It actually trickled into the Western Church via John Cassian and was reduced down to the seven deadly sins. You've heard of those, probably. The seven deadly sins are a kind of distillation of the eight bad thoughts that come out of the monastic tradition. But acedia being one of those. Acedia being this lack of care that comes up when in trying to do something, you become so distracted. Distraction is one manifestation of it. The saying says that when Anthony was struggling with acedia, he had a vision that he knew was from God. And in this vision, he saw a monk sitting in his cell to pray. And then this monk came outside and was weaving a basket. And then he would put the basket down and go back in his cell to pray. And then he would come back and weave his basket. That was it. That was the whole vision. And this was a great gift to Anthony, because this was the answer he'd been looking for. It sort of clicked for him that what God was saying was that the vocation that he had been called to pray without ceasing was a vocation of sitting in silence and working with his hands. Sitting in silence and working with his hands. And so he began to teach that to the desert monastics as a rhythm of life, a basic rhythm of life. And it took off. They would weave baskets, and then they would sit and pray. And they would weave baskets, and they would sit and pray. There was a great story told about one of these. After they had learned this habit, somebody came to one of these brothers and said, I have been struggling with the gospel text, or the epistle text that says to pray without ceasing. You know, he hadn't had Anthony's experience yet. He really wanted to do it. He said, I've been trying to figure out, how can I pray without ceasing? He said, oh, Father, tell me, how do you pray without ceasing? And he said, well, I say my prayers in silence. And when I weave my basket, I say the Jesus prayer. It's a breath prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, sinner. I pray. And I take the baskets that I make, and I sell them. And I sell them for two coins. One coin I use to buy my bread, and the other coin I leave outside of my prayer cell for the people who come by begging alms. And he said, and so I pray when I'm in silence, I pray when I work, and when I sleep, I trust that the beggars pray for me. And this is how I pray without ceasing. Beautiful, beautiful story. So this was what Anthony learned and then began to teach to the early monastic communities as a rhythm of life to combat acedia. Now, the context is quite different, but I'm more and more convinced that in our hypermobility and in our never-ending speed in this culture, people, almost all of us, are struggling with the spiritual condition of acedia. People are struggling with the spiritual condition of acedia. I want to name two manifestations of. Before I do, let me just say that if any of this resonates with you and you want to explore it more, I do have a chapter on this in the book on stability that's out there. But if you really want to dive into it, Kathleen Norris has written a great book called Acedia and Me, which is sort of a confessional memoir type book. But Kathleen has been wrestling with this for the past 20 years or so. And it's a really, I think, honest and helpful account both of her struggle and of the resources that the monastic tradition offers for addressing acedia. But acedia is going to be an issue for any community that tries to be a place for people, that tries to stay somewhere. Acedia is going to be an issue. And here are two manifestations of it that I see a lot. One is a kind of, and this is right there in the Desert Wisdom, that there are two sides to acedia. You think lack of care, and you think American teenager, right? Yeah, whatever. Who cares, right? Apathy or acedia as kind of almost a sort of depression. And there is that side to acedia. But the other side of acedia, and this is fascinating to me, the other side of acedia that the monastics name is hyperactivity. There's a way, and I think this is a much more indicting diagnosis of a lot of the acedia that we experience in our culture. It's a sort of constant activity and motion that's always about going to the next thing in a way that we never stop to care about the particular place or people or things that are in front of us, right? So speed leads to a kind of hyperactivity that is a lack of care. This is the one side of acedia. And I think that that the stories of some of our communities manifest this. I thought I would tell the story of a community that has told its own story, and so I don't feel so bad telling it. This is sort of hard stuff to confess. That's why I appreciate people like Kathleen who the subtitle of her book is about being a writer, and she mentions marriage in the subtitle. I can't remember the subtitle exactly, but she mentions marriage because a lot of the acedia that she sort of spells out is what she lived in her marriage, and she lost her husband a few years ago, so she kind of struggles through all of that in the book. So I appreciate the confessional nature of people who shared about this struggle. And there's a community that was in Jackson, Mississippi, called the Antioch Community. And it grew out of, I mentioned CCDA earlier. CCDA, the Christian Community Development Association, was started largely by the vision of a man named John Perkins. And John Perkins is from Mississippi, and he has an incredible story growing out of the civil rights movement. He grew up in rural Mississippi before there was anything near a civil rights movement going on. He said, I saw the white church, and that was a bunch of people who talked about Jesus but didn't listen to him. And I saw the black church, and that was a bunch of people who went into church on Sunday morning and got happy about Jesus and then went right back to living in this world that was killing them. And I didn't see much hope in either of that, he said. So I got out. And he went to Southern California. where he became a businessman and did pretty well. But his son went to this little Pentecostal church for a vacation Bible school, and he came home talking about Jesus. And I love to hear John talk about it. He says Spencer came home. He always pulls on his beard when he talks. He says, Spencer came home, and he was talking about this man Jesus, and I realized this Jesus had become more important in his life than I was, and I had to go hear about this Jesus too. And so he went to the church, and he became a Christian. And after he became a Christian, he heard God call him back to Mississippi. He got involved in a prison ministry in Southern California, and he realized when he went into the prison that they were all people from the South, black folks from the South, who'd gotten locked up in prisons in and around L.A. And he said he had to go back. And he told his wife, and she said, "But that's fine if that's what God's telling you, but I'm staying right here." But they worked through it, and they went back to Mississippi in the early 60s. So as these new evangelicals, you know, who Jesus has just grabbed hold of their life, and they want to share the message with kids and with prisoners. They started Bible clubs. You know, they were just going around with a flannel graph board and telling the stories. You know, and teaching people. But they got caught up in the civil rights movement because it was happening all around them, and that made sense to them too. So they were doing Bible teaching and civil rights alongside each other. And John has an incredible story of being nearly killed in the jail in Brandon, Mississippi by some police officers that beat him up and shoved a fork up his nose. And he stumbled out of there barely alive the next day and spent several months in a hospital. And in the hospital, Jesus came to him again and told him that he wanted him to love white people. And to work for reconciliation, and he spent the rest of his life doing that. But out of that experience, he started teaching what he called the three R's of community development. He says the three R's, the three R's of community development. You got to realize that the resources have left our community when everybody who could get out did. So we've got to have relocation to abandoned communities. And when people relocate, they have to bring their resources with them, and we have to have redistribution that allows for people who don't have resources to have resources. And then we can have reconciliation. So those are the three R's of CCDA. Well, they started that in Mendenhall, Mississippi, and then they started another ministry like that in Jackson, Mississippi. And, John's a great preacher, and he would go around preaching this, and people would come down and volunteer. So there were neighbors who got involved, and John's family and other people, and then these volunteers were often young white people who came to Mississippi. So there was this little young interracial church called Voice of Calvary in Jackson, Mississippi, and it was these black folks and white folks who were worshiping together. And you know, actually early in his career with Christianity Today, they sent Philip Yancey down to cover this story. Philip Yancey wrote a real nice story about how these white and black people were living together. And then, after it had been going off quite some time, John's son Spencer got up one day at a church meeting and said, "I want to know, what are all you white people doing here? And why is it that you run all the ministries? Even though you ain't from here, and most of you haven't been there that long." And that started a real honest conversation, lasted several months. And out of that conversation, Spencer and his family and another family, a white family, agreed to start a community together and to try in living out the Sermon on the Mount to try and figure out how they could actually be brothers and sisters together and not just, folks who were doing their own thing and coming together because, it felt right. So this Antioch community was really an incredible experiment, an interracial experiment that grew out of that Voice of Calvary ministry in Jackson. And they were together for, about a decade, and lots of people were inspired and moved by this ministry, and they were very active. This is what the people have shared who were part of that community. They had a lot to do. They were working with folks in the neighborhood. They offered hospitality to people who were coming out of prison and to folks from the neighborhood, you know, who became homeless. And they started this reconciliation ministry because, you know, there were so many people who were inspired by white and black folks. So they had people coming from all over, and they were going to talk to people about racial reconciliation. And there was a lot going on, and it was very busy. And the husband of the white couple, and Spencer, John's son, Chris was his name, and Spencer, they had really come together as leaders of this community, and they were really preaching this reconciliation message. They even started a national organization called Reconcilers, and had real groups all over the country that were working on this. And in the midst of that, after a decade of working and living together, and doing a lot, they realized that they couldn't stand each other. they both talked about this. Spencer wrote a good article about it that I think you can still find on Christianity Today's website. It's called "Playing the Grace Card," about what he learned through this. And Chris ended up writing a book about it called "Grace Matters." So, as I said, this is a story that's been told. But what happened when they had this crisis? They blew up. They couldn't stand each other. They told each other that. They talked about it in the community. The community couldn't figure it out. So they said, the community's got to die. We got to, you know, we can't go on. But they thought, well, before we just fold things up, they said, let's call these friends at another community in San Francisco, and let's see if they'll come down and just talk things through with us. You know, maybe we can at least die well, was their thought. So they called John and Judy Alexander, and they came down, and they spent some time with them, and they listened to Chris and all his complaints, and they said, yeah, okay. And they listened to Spencer and all his complaints, and this is the rest of the community, and about everything that's been going on there. And both of them told the same story, both Chris and Spencer, and others from the community have too. So I think it's worth telling as kind of a summary of what John and Judy said to them. They said that they all sat down for a meeting, and John said to them, "I have a question." He did a kind of Bible study on grace. He said, "I have a question about the Bible. Which is more important in the Bible, loving God or loving your neighbor?" Now, of course, they had all read Jesus, right? So they knew this was a trick question. And they said, "Well, of course it's both." And John said, No, but if you actually read the Bible, like, which one's in there more? And they said, "Not sure." And John said, "Well, I'm an anal person. I went through with a marker, and I highlighted all the verses about loving God, and I highlighted all the verses about loving your neighbor." Said, "And you know what I found out? That far more than verses about loving God and loving your neighbor are the verses about God's love for us." And he looked at this community of these hyperactive community developers and said, "Until y'all get that deep down in your bones, you're dangerous people." And that little dying community got born again. They got born again out of that, and had a real revival, a real coming to realize something new about their vocation. About as much as God calls us to do good things, you know, to love God and to love our neighbor, to do those things together. So we have to somehow internalize and find a rhythm for remembering God's love for us. It's a powerful, powerful story. Of course, the other side of acedia is that it does manifest itself sometimes in a way that looks like depression, that looks like not hyperactivity, but rather an inability to really get up and get going for anything. There's a There's a great passage in Soren Kierkegaard where he says, I don't feel like doing anything. I think to myself, maybe I should take a walk. But that seems like it would take too much energy. And so I think to myself, maybe I'll just lay here. But I don't feel like doing that either. You know, he just goes on and on like this. And this is acedia, or perhaps that's depression. There is even in the monastic literature, before they have the psychological language for it, there is a good bit of discernment that happens in determining whether the spiritual condition of a lack of care is actually what we're facing, or whether it's something physical, is how the monastics said it. They recognize that there are things that happen in our brains. And so this isn't a way to say that, you know, we might not have chemical conditions that need to be addressed, or that or that you know, if you live in a place like Vancouver, you know, you might need to get out in the sun.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are real physical things that affect our mood, and yet I think the spiritual condition, both for individuals and for communities, it can easily happen that there is an acedia that slips in when we don't quite have our rhythm. We haven't quite figured out how it is we remember what we're called to do and who we're called to be, you know, doing and being, or action and contemplation. When we haven't quite found that rhythm, there is kind of a restlessness or a dissatisfaction that acedia manifests itself as. And there's a powerful passage in Evagrius of Pontus. He's one of the kind of tourists who comes along and describes some of the wisdom of the monastic tradition. And when he's describing acedia, he says that what happens to the monk, they called it the noonday devil, because if you started praying in the morning and you'd set out to, you know, to pray all day, you might have a lot of energy at the beginning and have focus, and yet when you got to the middle of the day and the sun was up high and it was beating down on you, they said that there are a series of thoughts that come into your head, and as Evagrius said, the day begins to stretch out before you and you think that it will never end. Now think about that in terms of your ministry context. Have you ever been there? The days begin to stretch out before you and you thought, this will never end. That might be acedia. That might be acedia. They said that there are a series of thoughts that come to us when we face acedia in this manifestation. There are thoughts that come to say something like, didn't God say that we need to feed the hungry in the city? Maybe I'm not supposed to be here. Maybe I would be a better use elsewhere. Right? This is one of the voices of acedia. Or, God has given me certain gifts. Couldn't I better use them in a different context than here? Maybe I'm not living up to my full potential. This is another voice of acedia. These are the kind of things that the monastic tradition names. But I see this happening in community too. One of the most powerful articulations of it was a conversation that I got to have with Jean Vanier when he was in the States a few years ago, and we were talking about community. Jean is one of the great wisdom figures in the community movement. If you've never heard of L'Arche, L'Arche is the organization of communities that have core members who are people with developmental disabilities, and people who come to live with the core members, who are, in the words of Reynolds Price, who we recently lost in Durham, Reynolds Price used to call these people the temporarily abled. I like that name for those of us who can, you know, walk around and use our minds with, you know, relative normality. We're the temporarily abled. At any rate, the temporarily abled and the core members live together in community. Jean came to this because he was the son of a governor general from Canada, a prominent family, went into the Royal Navy, and after that did a PhD on Aristotle. I mean, here's a Renaissance man, you know, he's done everything. And you know, at 30 or whatever he was then, when he had finished, he realized that he had absolutely no clue what he should do with his life. And so he went to see his priest and said, what should I do with my life? And the priest said to him, you know, there's these two guys that just came out of a mental institution, and I think you should go live with them. And he said, okay. So he did. And out of that began this community that he's still part of people who live together with folks who have disabilities. Well, at any rate, that experience of living together and of helping to start other communities that work that way has taught Jean a great deal about community. And so one of the classic texts for life in community is Community and Growth. It's sort of Jean Vanier's big book of wisdom. And so all of our communities have poured over. It's kind of like the manual you go to, you know, when you can't remember why you're doing this or things are falling apart, you go and listen to Jean. And so it was a great gift to get to sit with him. When I was talking to him and talking about L'Arche, one of the things I asked was, you know, what's the hardest part after, you know, he's in his 80s now, you know, after more than 50 years of doing this. What's the hardest part? You know, you would think that the hardest part might be, you know, the real needs that people have when you're somebody who, you know, you are temporarily able, and yet, I mean, Jean tells stories about people that, you know, all you can do is hold them while they scream for hours, he's lived that life for 50 years. Or you might think that the hardest part might be the other folks who were there to help, you know, and the trying to live with them could be difficult, and I'm sure it sometimes is. But the hardest part, Joan said, the hardest part of community is, he said, the people who come, it's often young people. They come and they have lots of energy and they're very committed, and they're dear, dear people. And they spend a year or 2 years or 3 years with us. He said, and then they come and they say, he said, they have a word they use. He said, transformative. They say, this has been a transformative experience. And then they leave. He said, I think that's the hardest part. That's the hardest part for me. And I think that's a testament to the way that that acedia is often tempting us to reduce our vocations to an experience that we can wrap up and then move on to something else. I suspect that as often as it's named as a transformative experience, it's also named as somebody saying, this doesn't quite work for me, or I think I could be of better use elsewhere, or I think my gifts would be more appreciated elsewhere, or this kind of thing. And that, it seems, is another manifestation of the restlessness that's on this side of acedia. Well, I'm sort of dwelling here with the sea a little bit, trying to pull out the threads. It's a fairly complicated thing to name. I'm grateful to these ancient folks and the more contemporary ones who've helped us. It does seem to me that it touches on a lot of what people are struggling with in our time, and that it's connected to the speed at which we move in a pretty placeless society. But the other thing that I want to emphasize, and that I think is important here, is that in the midst of this, what can almost seem like a doldrum, or a place on the sea where you can't get anywhere. You're sort of stuck in it, and I think that's why a lot of us just try to move on to get beyond it. That in dwelling in that, I think our story in Scripture and the story of so many of these communities is that when we are committed to stay, God interrupts us in the midst of what seems like an impasse. I guess I would add to the powers that we've been trying to name this. Well, I think I mentioned this earlier, Kevin. I wanted to talk a little bit about how realism becomes a power, especially when things get hard. And I think that's often when a CEO attacks us, when the things that we've been called to gets hard. Realism says, well, you know, we can only do so much. The world is the way it is. You can't change everything. And so there's often a kind of attempt to save what you can and move on sort of attitude. And this, I think, is why I want to acknowledge the extreme difficulty that this can be in whatever setting you're in. Because I imagine, like, if you're anything like me, y'all have been in these places. You've been in these places where you're frustrated, you don't know if you can go on, you aren't sure how anything you're doing makes a difference. So I don't want to suggest that that you're simply facing a demon called acedia, and if you just had enough faith or something, it'd go away. That's not what I'm saying. What I do want to say is that I think we have a lot of stories that remind us that in the midst of that, God can interrupt. And especially for people who feel stuck within systems that they don't think could ever change. I'm thinking like a congregation that could never change, a community that can never change, a diocese or a denomination that you think, I mean, maybe some little things could change, but like the problem is that the whole thing's broken and I can't change it and I don't see that anybody else wants to. And so there can be a real urge to say, forget it. Let's move on. What I want to say is that in our story, I think God's interruption in these particular places is a sign of the new order that Paul is trying to celebrate in Ephesians, that that I think the whole New Testament says that we've entered into, and that is our hope. They can be signs of that, that point us toward that, and that remind us that God is already doing that, even if everything doesn't change. Even if everything doesn't change. And this is the kind of realism that I'm trying to advocate in our little communities and in the church. I was sketching this out earlier. I might sketch it out again. This is my understanding of New Testament eschatology. I think this has everything to do with how we read Ephesians. So let me just throw this out here because I think it'll help me tell the next story I want to tell. So if we read the Old Testament like Paul read the Old Testament, it starts with creation, and there's a history that begins and very quickly gets interrupted and messed up. Let's do this, by sin and rebellion against God, and after that, of course, there is God's move. God interrupts even there to cover Adam and Eve in garments of skin, and to begin a series of covenants that are God's promise that some restoration is going to happen. And if we pay attention to the prophets, that vision points toward a peaceable kingdom, where the lion will lay down with the lamb, where the swords will be beaten to plowshares, where they will study war no more. And that's where Messiah comes, right? For Paul and anybody who studied the scriptures in his tradition. Well, that's a great expectation. It's something that can kind of keep hope alive when things are very difficult. But this imagination actually proved particularly challenging for what God does in Jesus, because what happens is we got the same story,
covenants. We're going here. And Jesus shows up.
And whereas here, shouldn't have made this an arrow, this should be a dot. Whereas when Messiah comes, this ends and some new order begins up here, right? This is the peaceable kingdom. What the New Testament says that happens with Jesus is that this old order keeps going. Actually, it kills Jesus. The old order kills Jesus. And Jesus overcomes it at the resurrection. And there's a new order. And the eschatology of the New Testament says that this old order will have an end, and this kingdom will have no end. But in the meantime, we live here. We live in the time between the times. So I understand Ephesians to be about how do you remember this story of what God is doing in this time? And as we've now just turned the corner, the chapter 4, how does the community live together in this time? I think that's what Ephesians is about. And in this time between the times, the kind of realism that I want to advocate for is not what Reinhold Niebuhr called Christian realism. That is, that sometimes you're just going to have to get your hands dirty and do things down here this way. But rather, a realism that acknowledges that this is just as real as this. This order is just as real as this order. We have two competing realities that we're living in the midst of. It's what Paul calls the old order and the new order, the old self and the new self, the law of the spirit and the law of the flesh. I think these are different names for these two orders, and we're constantly being pulled between them. So there's sort of a decision to be made all the time about which way we're going to trust, which era we're going to trust. But the big news is, the big news that the church holds is that this order is real in the here and now. The Holy Spirit makes it possible to live in this order now. And to the extent that we don't, Paul says, we're living under the law of the flesh, and we're trusting the old self. And that only leads to death, he says. So he's always calling these little communities, early Christians, to trust and live in this order. Well, all that to say that I think the signs that interrupt. Like in John's Gospel, right? Signs and wonders, miracles that happen with Jesus. From there, all through the church, whether it's, Peter raising up a person outside the temple gates, or, people being raised from the dead, any of the signs and miracles that happen in the church that happen even now, I think are signs that point us toward the power and reality of this order, the power of the resurrection. And those interruptions, I think, are what we're called to trust. To trust the interruptions and to, in this language of experiments that I've been using, to conduct experiments that follow up on the interruptions. So it's not even about us being radically creative or strategic in figuring out how we're going to experiment with something that will turn into a new model for the church. But it's about us experimenting in the truth of what we have learned from the interruptions. Now, that's fairly abstract, so let me tell the story. I wanted to tell the story about how our community came to be. Part of what got me thinking about this a decade ago was that just after 9/11, I was working as a reporter for a Christian nonprofit in Philadelphia that was interested in global engagement. And so they assigned me to cover faith and politics after 9/11. And that's when I started talking to people about this war on terror that was emerging in our culture and that the church was talking about. And I started talking to people about what the church has to say about this. And that's when I learned from people who said, we have to go to war, this concept of Christian realism that we got from Reinhold Niebuhr in the 20th century. But I found it deeply unsatisfying, even when I talked to the people who knew the just war tradition, because the people who knew the just war tradition and would lay out the criteria that we get from Augustine and Aquinas and others who came after them, would say, however necessary the war might be, the just war criteria don't seem to say that Christians could be involved in this war. Almost all of the experts in just war I talked to told me that. And then, of course, there were the pacifists who said, we just don't do war. But what are you going to do, right? I mean, this is kind of the conflict. So I was kind of struck by this, just as a Christian who was reporting on something that was happening in the church. I thought, this is a rather desperate impasse. All of the traditions we have for reflecting on war tell us not to go to war. But then I went down to the Pentagon and I interviewed this guy in Paul Wolfowitz's office, and he said to me, we're going to war. this guy, we talked about just war, because he had actually studied just war at Harvard. He took a course on just war at Harvard's Divinity School. And he said, I understand the criteria very well. There are many people here in the Pentagon who understand these criteria. He said, but it doesn't matter. He said, Paul Wolfowitz wants to go to war. We're going to go to war. He told me that in the fall before 2003. So it was clear that we were going to war. The tens of thousands of Christians who were enlisted in the military, you know, were or already or were going to be deployed. But then everything we had to teach us to think about it said that we shouldn't go to war. Not that the country shouldn't go to war, but the Christians. Christians shouldn't be involved in this war. It's not just. If you believe in a just war tradition, the very basis of it is that there's some wars you got to say no to. That's John Yoder, who was a Mennonite, he used to actually teach the just war tradition, because he said nobody takes it seriously. He said, I'm a Mennonite, I believe in pacifism, but I'll teach the just war tradition because I'd like people to take it seriously. And he said, we hardly have a just war in the United States anymore. Well, all we really have is the justify any war tradition. We have a justify any war tradition. But I found this deeply troubling as a young Christian reporter, and I started asking, is there anybody doing anything else? And I learned about this group called the Christian Peacemaker Teams. And the Christian Peacemaker Teams, ever since the early 90s, have been doing direct action nonviolence in conflict zones. So here's people from denominations that are peace church, you know, pacifist folks, but also folks who come from, you know, Presbyterian and Lutheran. Yeah, I actually learned in this process that the Lutherans are the only people who've made just war doctrine. It's in one of y'all's confessions of faith. I can't remember which one, but somebody told me it's a tradition in every other denomination, but it's doctrine for the Lutherans. Just war is doctrine. But anyway, so there's people from just war and pacifist traditions who are part of this group that says, well, if Jesus showed us a kind of active nonviolence that is an alternative to the way things operate in this order, you know, if there is a different way to go about things, this way that Paul seems to be living out, you know, by embracing suffering in prison rather than forsaking his call, then they said we ought to be active in living that out. Actually, the person who kind of gave the call to start the organization said, if we believe in the cross in the 20th century and the power of the cross, what we have to do is be willing to put ourselves in harm's way when there are conflicts going on. Otherwise, we ought to just be called people who sit back and don't do anything and never complain about the military, because they're at least doing something. That's what he said. And so they got it started. And I was deeply impressed by both the conviction and the practice of this organization that was in the fall of 2002 already in Iraq and building up a presence of what they called a peace team. And my wife and I, we were so impressed by them that we sent a letter to their office here in Chicago, and we said, we are so grateful for what y'all are doing, and, you know, we're just young 20-somethings here in Philadelphia. But if there's anything we can do to help, y'all just let us know. And they sent a letter back and said, we're sending a delegation to Baghdad in 2 weeks. Can you join us? And he said, oh, well. I thought maybe put some stamps on letters or something. So we called him and said, we're not really qualified, I don't think. Surely you have some people you've trained or something for this. And they said, we have a lot of experienced people going. I think you could sort of get in and figure it out. All right. So we prayed with our church and they sent us to join this team in the spring of 2003, and we ended up going to Iraq in the midst of the bombing that was happening, and being in Baghdad while it was under the Shock and Awe campaign, and visiting people in their homes who side of the building had been blown out, or the whole street out in front had been destroyed. We went to the hospitals and visited with people whose family members were there, and just heard heart-wrenching stories of loss and a good bit of anger. I remember one man in the hospital saying, if this is democracy, we don't want it. If this is liberation, you can keep it, he said. And yet we were so impressed by the graciousness and the hospitality of Iraqis who, dozens of people said to us, we love Americans. We don't like your president very much, but we love Americans. The Iraqis had and have an incredible ability to distinguish between bad leadership and people. Of course, they had to live under this. They have had to live under this themselves for so long. But after we had been there for not very long, just before Saddam's regime fell, as it would happen 2 days before it fell, Saddam's people, we didn't know, but of course Saddam was already underground somewhere, but his people kicked us out of the country for not obeying their every command. They were a hyper-controlled state to begin with, and when they were being bombed, they really wanted obedience. And we had gone down the street one day when a bomb went off not far from us, just to visit and see what had happened and see if we could do anything for people. And we were talking with a shop owner who was showing us through his destroyed business, and in the midst of showing us this and weeping and actually showing us where he had been laying and had just peed his bed, when this explosion happened. He's showing us this, just disoriented. He sends his son down into the cellar and brings out this crate of Pepsis and starts passing it around and saying, we're so glad you're here. You're welcome. And just, incredible hospitality. But in the midst of that, the police showed up and we were arrested, taken in, and deported the next day. And so we had to leave the country. And on our way out of the country, in three different cars, one of the cars, on this highway that was, 2 weeks of being bombed, cars burned out, bridges collapsed. One of the cars in our group hit a piece of shrapnel on the road and blew a tire and careened into this side ditch, and three guys split their heads open right there in the middle of this road in the desert. And I was in a car in front of them, and the other car was also in front of them, so we didn't even notice that it happened. And we were driving 80, 85 miles an hour on a road where you're just, weaving between debris. And so we didn't notice they were gone until we got to the border with Jordan. And we waited and waited and waited, and they didn't come. And finally, this van of Somalians came. We had met these Somalians when driving through the Western Desert. You can't make it through the Western Desert on one tank of gas, which is a problem when all the road has been bombed out for 2 weeks because all the gas stations are closed. So when we ran out of gas, we had to pull into one of these gas stations, and it's closed, and we didn't know what we were going to do, so we're standing around scratching our heads, and this van of Somalians pulls up. They don't even stop. They just go right around to the back of the gas station, and then they come pushing the van back around to the pumps, and they start pumping gas. And I said to these guys, what did you do? They said, we took the battery out of our van and hooked it up to the pump at the back, and they said, get all the gas you want. Nobody cares. And I said, how did you know how to do that? He said, oh, we're from Somalia. We do this all the time. So they had helped us make it through the desert. And so when they saw us on the side of the road, they pulled over and they told us that they had seen our other car turned over in this ditch. And they said, we got out and checked, but nobody was there. And they said, we don't know what happened. So we turned around and we went back, and we saw the car too. And the car had wrecked just a mile outside of this little village called Rutba. Now, there's not much out there in that desert. So the proximity to this town was something of a miracle. And we went into the town. We found our friends. They told us how they had wrecked. They got out of the car. They were bleeding. They were standing on the side of the road. They're looking around. They're not sure what they're going to do. You know, this is like, as far as you can see, flat sand. And this car of Iraqis stopped, took them into their car, drove them into this town of Rutba. And there they found the doctor from the hospital. He wasn't at the hospital because he said to them, 3 days ago, your country bombed our hospital. We don't have a hospital anymore. He said, but we'll take care of you. And he took them into this little house that, where they had some medical supplies, and he sewed up their heads and saved their lives. So that's where we found them. We found one of them standing outside, waving his hand, and we heard this story and talked to this doctor and thanked him for what he had done. And we said, what do we owe you for your services here? You know, we want to get our friends on to the hospital, but please, let's pay you for what you've done. And he said, no, please. He said, don't pay me anything. He said, please just go and tell people what's happened here in Rutba. So we came back to the United States in 2003 telling that story. And the more we told that story, the more we realized that we had lived the Good Samaritan story. You know, that the people who were supposed to be our enemies had stopped and picked our friends up out of the ditch and saved their lives. And at the end of that story, Jesus says, go and do likewise. And we knew that was a word for us. So that was the interruption. That was the interruption that that happened to us in 2003. And after talking to some of the people that we had been in Iraq with and just trying to discern and pray, we went to Durham, North Carolina, and started this community called the Rutba House, named after that little village of Rutba. So I say that to say that the little experiment of our community and our way of life and the different kinds of ministries and such that have grown out of that has mostly been a response to an interruption that happened, and to trying to read that interruption in light of the scriptures that we have, and to see that the Good Samaritan story has power when Jesus tells it to those Jews, because there's a real material relations, you know, there's a real context to the dispute between those two peoples, and yet that story has been lived over and over again in the history of the church. And for us, it was the good Iraqi, the good Muslim doctor who showed us what God's love looks like and who God used to give us the call to be, as y'all were calling it, a little school for love, a little school where we can learn to love together with our neighbors and where others can be together with us in that process. And it was shortly after we had started the community when we got a call from these Benedictines in Minnesota. And somehow, I think through one of these stories about what had happened in Rutba, they heard about what we were doing. And they said, we're very excited to hear that young people are wanting to do Christian community together. They said, we have a Christian community here, but we're a lot of old people. It's exciting to hear about young people doing this. And I remember they said, you know, this community thing, it's kind of hard, especially if you want to stick at it for a while. And so we thought, you know, some questions might come up since y'all are just getting started. And just wanted to let you know that if you ever have any questions, you know, we've been doing this for 1,500 years. So feel free to come visit. And so we took them up on that and started a relationship with them and began to learn from Benedictine something about this rhythm of life that had come down to them from Antony and others beginning in the desert. And I think I just wanted to say from our experience that the rhythm that's been most important is this rhythm of the liturgy that we've kind of been practicing here together, but that is a way of constantly drawing us back into the story and back into the memory of the people of God in a way that we tell it, we say it, we sing it, and we pray it, and then we go and do our work, and then we come back and do it again, and then we go and do, you know, what's before us to do, and we come and do it again. I think this is an invitation into the new imagination that we've been talking about here. It's a rhythm that always brings us back into that imagination, and it helps us see the tension that exists between these two orders, between the times that we're living in the way that the world names time, and the times that we're living in the history of the people of God. When we put together this common prayer book a couple of years ago, we decided that one of the things we were going to do out of our communities and our experience in running prayer together is to really be intentional about holding the world's time up against the churches and God's people's time. So we just, for example, in this country, celebrated July the 4th. And, of course, you know, as we were naming the power of nationalism, around July the 4th, there's a lot of storytelling that goes on in our culture. My son loves fireworks. But I'm going to tell you, having lived a week in Baghdad under bombs, I can't celebrate fireworks anymore. Because they're a symbol. And they're a symbol that tells a story about what this country is founded upon. The bombs bursting in air gave proof through the night that the flag was still there. If that's our foundation story, I'm deeply disturbed by it. And so in the liturgy, acknowledging that that's the time that we, you know, live amongst in this world, we also remember on July the 4th that it's the saint day for Saint Martin of Tours. And Saint Martin of Tours, of course, was the soldier who, when he met Jesus in a beggar who he gave half of his cloak to, he said, I am a soldier of Christ. I can no longer carry a sword. Now, that's a memory that's rather disruptive of the memory of this culture that we live in. On the same day that our neighbors are shooting off fireworks and remembering the bombs that burst in the air that gave rise to our nation, we remember a saint like Martin of Tours. I think that kind of tension is the tension that we have to keep alive in this memory of the people of God. And liturgy has a way of doing that. So I think what liturgy does is liturgy is a constant reminder of how we're interrupted by the story and the memory of God's people, how this divide between, you know, the new era and the old era is really within us. I think Paul's language of the new self and the old self is helpful because it says that, you know, it's not like the fundamentalists, you know, who say, we're going to be in the world and not of it. We're going to build, you know, walls that are big enough to keep us away from the influence of the culture around us. And as so many people who grew up in that have acknowledged, what actually happens is you end up being of the world and not in it. You know, the exact opposite of what you're trying for, because the world is inside us, right? The old self is there. And if we shut ourselves off from those around us, it doesn't get rid of that. It just means that we have a Christian music industry and a Christian publishing industry and a Christian, we have Christian, we have testaments.
Yeah.
You ever seen them?
Yeah.
They come in a little can. You know, little mints you can eat. Testaments. Little witness you can share with your neighbor when you're out there in the world. Anyway, all that to say that this liturgy has been a way for our community of having a rhythm that reminds us of the story and of the new time that we're living in. And I think that stirs up, that constantly being interrupted by that story stirs up a vocation of being interrupters. We interrupt because we've been interrupted. And so I think to faithfully practice the liturgy is to be engaged in taking the liturgy to the streets, in moving from our worship into creative interruptions of the world around us. And We found that as we pray and as we remember these stories and as we try to pay attention to what's happening in the places where we are, these things just kind of come up. Several years ago during Lent at our community, we had just come through a very difficult season of Advent and of Epiphany, in which our state was executing someone almost every week. There was kind of a backlog of cases that had been in appeals, and the executions had ramped up, and we had been vigiling for a long time alongside others from churches and from anti-death penalty groups. We would vigil outside and pray when these things happened, but beginning in Lent one year, we realized that we really needed to repent of the idolatry that was involved in our state's practice of execution. We started looking real closely, and as can only happen in the Bible Belt, our protocol for execution in North Carolina said that the person to be executed had to be served a last meal, a last supper on Thursday, and they had to be executed on Friday. Now, y'all are preachers. Y'all can imagine where this came from. In the South. And what we did is we, as Christians, we got together, and our community with several other people in the area, we said that this is a sort of idolatry that comes out of a security state that says, you know, in this myth of redemptive violence, that we have to kill one more person to guarantee our security and our salvation as a people. And we had seen it performed so many times. We said, as Christians, we can't participate in it anymore. And so what we did is we took our liturgy right out to the street, and we started planning worship services where we would march right up to the prison and block the door so that the people who were doing the execution couldn't get in. And of course the police would come. And they would arrest us and take us away, but we kind of began to have a drama that was shaped a lot like church, and all these police officers were people who went to church, so we went over to the divinity school where I and several other people in this group had studied and teach at various times, and. We borrowed from the dean's office several robes. I'm not sure if he knew we were borrowing them or not, but we borrowed them. And we got a whole host of ministers, you know, dressed up to come in and lead the worship service, since we knew that there was going to be a great congregation there of people dressed in uniforms. And so we planned the service, and we went in and we had singing, and we had the scripture, and we read the scripture about how Jesus had died once and for all for our sins. And then, meanwhile the police are telling us, you know, this is your second warning if you don't leave. And then I preached. I preached in this worship service right there in front of the prison. And I preached the same gospel I grew up hearing. The same gospel that I know everybody there knows. I preached the simple gospel of Jesus dying on the cross, dying for your sins and for mine, and for that brother that y'all are going to kill tonight, that we are going to kill tonight. You know, this is our state. And if we believe that, if we believe that Jesus died so that nobody else would have to die, then we can't let it happen. And we said, and the only people who can stop it is us. We are the people of this state, and you are the people who work for this prison. And so I said, let us join hands together and go in here and stop this. And it was an incredible experience to see these officers who had been in church, I think many of them all their lives, weeping in that place and struggling with this call, with this interruption of God on our lives, and we were crying and they were crying, and the execution still went on that night, but I think something began to happen there, something began to happen in the hearts of all of us, and and we eventually went to trial. We made our defense in court a necessity defense so that we could testify in court to why we had to do what we did. Of course, the law provides that if a lesser law has to be broken to keep some greater evil from happening, then you can do that. That's why you can speed when you have, you know, somebody who's sick, you know, in your car, or a pregnant woman. You know, you can speed to the hospital. You won't get a ticket for that. That's the necessity defense. And so we made that defense and said that as Christians we had to do this so that both the idolatry and the murder that was planned wouldn't happen. And it was a long trial. The judge was very gracious, let us make the whole case in court. And at the end of the day, he did find us guilty of what we were charged, but he dismissed any penalty for the charges. And what happened after that was something that we could not have imagined. We did realize in the courtroom that God was doing something, even the people who testified, because the state called. Well, the judge first called me to the stand. The judge said, "Can you please explain what case you would like to make?" And I briefly laid this out. And the first question the judge asked was, "Could you tell me how you read Romans 13?" I thought, this is going to be good. So we had a discussion about submission to the authority of the state. I said, the Bible was right there, so I opened it up and read it to the judge, read it to the court. Said, you know, they keep it on the stand. It's there, so you can swear on it. Nobody ever opens it, but we opened it up and started reading it. And I said, "Your Honor, I believe in Romans 13 in the same way Martin Luther King did. I believe that that an unjust law is no law at all. And the only way to bring an unjust law before this court is to break it." And I said, "I believe in submitting to the authorities. I'm here to submit to your authority. We submit to you the justice of the death penalty." And he said, "You may proceed." So we got to make our case. And in making our case, the state, of course, called the police officers to testify. And so that they wanted them to speak to the facts, and they did. They said, indeed, that we were there, and we were told to leave, and we didn't leave. But then they started interjecting. These police officers started saying, but we do want to say that they always told us beforehand exactly what they were going to be doing. And they were always very nice, and we respect them a great deal. And these officers were you know, shaking our hands outside, and one of them actually said to one of us, "Y'all keep doing what you're doing, because we can't do it, but you can." And so after the trial, we read in the papers just a few days later that the state medical board had issued a statement to all of its doctors, and the protocol in North Carolina also says that a doctor has to be in attendance for the carrying out of lethal injection. And the state medical board had said that it would be a violation of the Hippocratic Oath for doctors to be involved, even though they had been involved for years and years. They just made this statement and said that from that point on, if any doctors participated, that they would lose their license from the state of North Carolina. And so it's been stuck in a legal battle ever since. We still haven't officially gotten rid of the death penalty, but no one's been killed since then in North Carolina because the prison sued the doctors and the doctors, you know, fought back, and it's all been tangled up in the court since then. And I say all that to say that that kind of interruption that ended up involving people that we didn't even know we would get wrapped up with, you know, police officers that were sympathetic and doctors who never talked to us about it, but however it happened, the timing coincided. All of that happened because the liturgy, the strange time of the church's year that calls us to repentance in that season of the church, of the state killing so many people, sort of led us out into that action in the streets. So I think to be interrupted communities that are interrupted by God, God's story in this new era that we're living in, is to be an interruption in the world and to be inviting other people to receive that interruption, to see what it points to for them.